This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Alex.
And welcome back to On Air. It's another Wednesday. These weeks seem to come by so fast, don't they?
They fly by. Also, I love your energy in this intro. That was a really like, welcome. I'm thinking, who's put 50p in Dan? How are you?
Because it's almost Christmas. You can see the finish line in sight now.
Yes.
Don't you feel
that's
that?
True. Yeah, yeah, of course. I don't, you know, there's like a moment where you feel, I feel like I felt it more couple weeks back, but that's because we've been moving around the world, and also we're in different parts of the world where they're not celebrating Christmas as much as our respective home countries where family are, at least. So yeah, but
don't you also feel that these are the most hectic weeks, like at least
crazy
until a few days before Christmas? The past few weeks have just been like literally nonstop. I got an Aura ring, by the way, which keeps telling me I'm way too stressed. So I'm like, thank you for the acknowledgement. Thank you.
So just this morning on Reddit, I was reading about a guy who was driving and he feels his finger twitching and he looks down and his Aura ring is on fire on his finger.
Excuse me.
The Aura ring is a lithium ion battery, and he struggled to get it off because it was like contracting, becoming smaller. Oof. It was on fire and he couldn't get it off, and they like doused it in water or something and it ended up coming off. And then he took it to Reddit and he was like, you know, do you think I should let customer service know? And people were like, are you crazy? You need to sue. That was this morning. So congratulations. Great. On your new purchase. How's it going?
I mean, I got it almost for free with the Black Friday sale plus an American Express credit you get now in the US. So I wanted to try
Excuse
it out.
Excuse me. Was that an advert? Because if
it
that was
literally,
an advert.
It was not. It was just that I literally, otherwise
How
I wouldn't have
you?
Bought it because it feels so unnecessary.
So American. Honestly, trust the American on the podcast to come and be like, funny story, I got it with the American Express.
My referral, link will be in the description of this.
Seriously,
episode.
You know when you watch the TV adverts of a pharmacy in America and it's like, side effects might include dying or nearly dying or blah, blah, blah. That's what you sounded like.
And you know what? I just read some study or watched some YouTube video recently that said that those disclaimers are actually like they have a positive effect on people's perception of a product. The more disclaimers, the more people are like, oh wow, they're very honest, I like this, and more likely
what?
To want to buy it. Yeah,
anytime I'm in the US, I always associate it with kind of being in the bathroom getting ready and the TV is on in the living room and hearing these adverts, and I'm hearing and I'm like, you know, maybe it was an advert for what I initially thought was just a yogurt or something. and then it's like diabetes, stroke or dying. What? Yeah, it's just insane that their list that they go through I thought it would have the reverse effect. I thought it would ensure that you don't buy it, you know?
I know, but apparently people do. I guess it's like a comforting type of thing. Anyway, let's move on from Aura rings and let's
before we do, and this is not about the Aura ring, but it is just a message to anyone listening, planning things, whether you're planning a conference or planning a networking event, perhaps you're planning to unveil or reveal. Why are you all doing it in the same 18 days of December pre-Christmas? It is insane. Nobody can catch a breath. The schedule in the aviation sector, in the travel sector, and then anything that touches travel is insane with these conflicts, and you can't be in multiple places. I just thought, little public service announcement, if this is you listening to this, as a responsible, would be a great idea to explore. What about September? Nobody touches September. What about September? What about April? You know, what about it?
What about even June? June is a great month. That's when we went to the amazing Riyadh Air fashion show, which was at a perfect time to travel. It's not like, come to our event in December in Hamburg. It's like, I would rather not, but thank you.
Yes, true. But it's not also because I'd rather not. It's just because, as you know, everything else takes time or you're booked ahead with things. And so it is weird. But this year, I think, has gone particularly fast. I know everyone says that, and it almost becomes a cliche. I don't necessarily think it's true for most of the year. But as I predicted, September until now, that was a blink of an eye. That was extremely, extremely quick.
Yeah, it was. It definitely was. But
well,
now,
you know who else can't catch a breath?
The poor folks at Indigo.
Yeah, we have a lot of listeners across India, and we also hear a lot of from passengers who are flying to and from the nation and across all of the several cities. And India has arguably trying to become an aviation powerhouse. Slightly different episode, of course, to last week, where we had a more in-depth discussion on what was happening with Air India. We're not going to be doing that today, but India is headline news at the moment. They are suffering what they are referring to as the greatest aviation meltdown in recent or modern aviation history. Dan, what is happening?
So, should we start with the backstory here?
I think that's a good place to start.
Let's start at the very beginning. Okay, sorry, I'm not going to sing on the podcast, but basically, you know, from Sound of Music, it's a very good place to start.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Yeah, yeah. Okay, your singing was so shit, I didn't recognize it. Okay, go on.
Thank you. I was trying not to, you know, go fully belting on the podcast. So anyway, yes. India, actually, 2 years ago, announced that they would be updating their pilot rest and duty time rules, not only for IndiGo, but for all airlines based in India. And this is basically to ensure healthier, happier pilots and therefore safer aviation. So actually a very good development, if you think about last week's discussion, should also help pilot mental health, of course. So some of these updated rules that were going to be put in place, again, with 2 years' notice, were, for example, a minimum weekly rest increasing from 36 hours to 48 hours a week, a nighttime flying cap of 10 hours, maximum 2 late night landings per week, which I think sounds like a great rule, mandatory quarterly fatigue reporting, another thing that I really like the sound of. And finally, leave cannot count as rest. So pilots having vacation time is not the same as rest time, which I also think is amazing because, as we know, a lot of the time going on vacation, going on a trip, is not just laying on the beach. It's actually really exhausting. And sometimes you get back to work or whatever more tired than when you left because you've been so busy wandering around. So those are some of the updates that IndiGo was facing. But what happened, Alex?
Well, IndiGo was not prepared for India's new pilot rest and duty time rules, which is being referred to as the FDTL. And despite the fact that they had the 2 years' notice where of the new weekly rest rules, that, as Dan said, the night flying being capped, the max late night landings, and so on, they had not planned. And there's that saying, isn't there, where you know, if you fail to prepare, then prepare to fail. And that's what we have seen play out. Since December 2nd, IndiGo has cancelled thousands and thousands of flights. There are various figures floating about that there are at least 4,000 cancellations in 1 week so far only. On the worst day, we had 1,600 plus flights cancelled. Just remember, that's 1,600 times by around 220 on board. You're talking about a lot of people caught up in this meltdown. On Monday, we've had hundreds of cancellations, including at their biggest cities. And there are essentially thousands of passengers stranded across India, because they should have been flying, let's say, perhaps on December 3rd or December 4th, and IndiGo has not been able to fully get to grips with the fact that because they were not ready, and therefore legally their schedule, their operation, and their roster was no longer valid or in line with these new rules, then it was just, you know, all hell broke loose. The airline was essentially frozen while they came to grips with how they move forward with this, and they're still coming to grips with it now. We're not talking to you based on them having a solution, but rather they're hopeful that they will be recovered by around this time next week.
Mm-hmm.
This is an incredibly busy travel period, not just because of Christmas, but December always is as you approach the new year. And also there are various different reasons as to why people are moving about in any given week, especially in India, where domestic air travel is a whole powerful economy of its own. And so what we've seen is the meltdown, is the total collapse of part of India's air travel system, of which IndiGo is the biggest player in that sense. And so this has been absolutely everywhere. I'm sure you've seen the videos. Have you seen the videos of the people screaming and tired and taking it out on the staff? And did you see the lady
who stood up on the counter?
Yes. And was screaming? Yes, yes, yes.
I mean, I was just happy there was like a glass wall or like at least plastic between her and the staff. But it's one of those things where management fails to plan. Who gets punished for it? The frontline staff who are not paid a lot. A lot of them in India are very young. They don't have much experience dealing with this kind of stuff. And they don't deserve any of the, frankly, harassment that they're receiving, when it should all be directed to management. Because the huge question here is, how on earth, with so much notice, did this airline still fail to plan? Was it, you know, a matter where they didn't actually expect it to go into effect? Is that what's behind this? What do we think?
We don't know, and that's the unusual part, because as you say, this was clearly, and you would also think that the wake-up call of what happened with Air India and the fact that there are questions over pilot mental health and self-reporting and fatigue and everything that we've discussed, you would think that that would have them take this even more seriously. I mean, they've been having to buy full-page advertisements in the Indian press, the traditional newspapers, where it simply says, "We're sorry," with underneath with IndiGo. I mean, they know they have let down the country and also everyone. I mean, if you just happen to book IndiGo in this period, what terrible luck, because IndiGo is partners with so many different airlines, and also it is a great way to be able to reach secondary, third cities across India that are not as well connected by the legacy carriers.
Yeah.
And yet they've let themselves get to this, and it's all still, you know, going out now. The Federation for Indian Pilots described it as the most short-sighted planning that they had seen. They said it was cartel-like behavior. There's been criticism from the former AirAsia CFO that pilots are saying that IndiGo, this is evidence of them prioritizing costs over rests, and that their plan to kind of ignore this didn't work. The government have had to step in to exempt IndiGo from the policy, because it's the policy that they were not prepared for. So they've had to exempt them from this for a short period of time to allow them to get back on their feet, to allow the operation to continue, and then ensure a more, you know, gradual transition into the new rules. But it hasn't worked at the moment. And then that's the reality. The cancellations have continued. There is a pilot shortage and the staff are unhappy. Morale is at an all-time low. And it's just really not a good look for IndiGo, to be honest. And let's
also remember that IndiGo, it was at least, and probably still is, India's favorite airline. People like this airline way, way more than they like Air India in general. It has a much better reputation, much more favorable image. So obviously this is an unfortunate development for them, but if they recover, you know, things like this happen in the US all the time, for example. So airlines recover there, and in India, I'm sure IndiGo will recover. And
well, aviation is incredibly, incredibly resilient, and people have short memories at some of the, you know, crazy things that happened this year. And thankfully, aviation just very quickly bounces back. It is such a well-oiled system with so many great people working across the global industry that we often take these things for granted. And we know at the same time also how fragile it all is, because, you know, just one IT failure and look what happens, and the reach is so far. Look at the power station fire near to Heathrow and how that impacted, you know, air travel in South America because of it, and because of the prominence of Heathrow as a hub. So that's the thing. We're such a small world in aviation. Everything is so globalized that although this is primarily an Indian story of a Indian predominantly domestic carrier, again, there will be passengers who were never interested in flying this airline that are caught up in the chaos of all this. And also all the thousands of people at airports around the world because they were supposed to be on IndiGo flights. And that then quickly becomes that airport's problem. And then there's the complaints are they were not given water, they were not provided food. And it's like, oh, it just all gets very, very messy very, very quickly.
Exactly. And let's remember, by the way, if you are or were scheduled to fly IndiGo out of Europe, EU 261 compensation should apply in this case, because the airline is not facing an extraordinary circumstance. They definitely knew this was coming, and that should be a bit of a wake-up call for them. So you should be able to get 600 euros in compensation if you were impacted and your flight originates in the EU or the UK.
And I know I've told this story before, but it is sometimes worth going the extra mile when the airline says no, whether it's to the equivalent of a small claims court like they have in the UK, or to larger courts, because and I won't tell the full story because it's in a previous episode somewhere, but of remember the gentleman who got in touch to prove that British Airways had not planned for the winter season with adequate de-icing instruments. So where BA were trying to blame weather, which exempts them from the compensation, he was quite sure that actually it was that BA had not planned to have not planned well enough for the winter weather, leaving them with only one or two de-icers for the crazy big freeze that happened in that year. And he pursued and he won. And so these things are, you know, it's just important to have these things in your back pocket. And Dan and I are always on hand if any of you are unsure as to how to navigate that, because we like answering those questions because they help the rest of you as consumers.
Exactly. Just a quick story. I have a friend who is an extreme budget traveler, and he took a trip with some friends to Bosnia a few weeks ago from Sweden. He was flying Ryanair, and lo and behold, the flight was delayed like 4 hours. So I told him that him and his five friends, I think, who were on the trip, should all be eligible for 250 euros in compensation. And go figure, for the entire trip, flights, hotels, everything, they had spent less than that much per person. So they should actually get, you know, a profit from it. Ryanair responded. And of course, they're saying this excuse always baffles me and concerns me. They blamed it on Swedish air traffic control delaying them. So not allowing them to depart on time from their origin in Bosnia. But of course, no other flights were delayed. So I'm always, it's a difficult one to argue. But in those cases, I just ask
to prove.
For, exactly. I mean, but in those cases, you just need to ask for evidence from the airline.
Yeah. But then that's when Ryanair communication usually stops.
Yeah.
Because they know to try and avoid all this.
Exactly. And that's when you turn to a company like AirHelp or whatever to at least get, you know, 200 euros is better than no euros, even if you don't get your 250.
Yeah. I mean, this is unusual, but valid advice. But if you, for example, found yourself on an EasyJet flight in a couple of weeks and it was delayed, let's say 3 hours, and perhaps it was 2 hours at the gate and then 1 hour on board, if you can remember to record the pilot's announcement where the pilot is providing the reason, that itself can be perhaps the greatest piece of evidence, because what usually happens is, let's say, for example, he's saying, oh, you know, the engineers have been at the aircraft and unfortunately, blah, 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 but we're fixing it and we're going to get on our way soon and blah, blah, blah. What often happens is that by the time you fly and then you land and then you put that claim in, you get this automatic response, or not even an automatic response, but a natural response saying anything but technical, saying that, for example, as Dan said, oh, due to air traffic control restrictions or due to, you know, circumstances beyond our control, they will do anything to get out of it. And yet, if you can then make sure that you have the evidence to be able to go back and say, well, actually, this is what the pilot announced, then I know several that have won in that scenario as well, and they quickly give in. So it's, it's just about making sure that you can get what you can get in those moments in terms of that gathering evidence to ensure that you are receiving what you legally and lawfully are owed in these events of big delays.
Exactly. Nice. So another story. This is some positive news, finally. Actually, we have two pieces of positive news this week, probably more, but we want to focus, first of all, on Korean Air, our friends over in Seoul, who have announced that they will offer free Starlink soon fleet-wide, making them the first major Asian airline to announce this. And it's awesome, considering that Korean Air previously did not even have in-flight Wi-Fi on a lot of their aircraft.
They just had magazines.
Yeah. Oh, bless them. No, they had good entertainment, but it's actually wild to go from no Wi-Fi to Starlink, which, of course, is free for all passengers because it has to be free for all passengers.
And elaborate on why it has to be free for all passengers. That's because
that's
contractually, it's the requirement from SpaceX. Yeah. So yeah,
exactly.
This is good. And of course, I just want to say that I think we were right very early on to call this. I think Starlink is the greatest disruptor and development in air travel for the last decade. I really do not think there has been anything as significant in Starlink changing the way of flying. And I know, for those that haven't experienced it, you might be thinking, he's just talking about Wi-Fi. We've had Wi-Fi plans. But it really is so much more than that, because not only is it lightning fast, not only is it absolutely reliable and no buffering, but it's also everything that it presents. Let's think beyond the passenger experience. And for passengers, it's great. You know, your Ring doorbell goes off, you can answer it. Oh, just leave the parcel on the side, please. Yeah, you're at 41,000 feet. You know, you want to stay in touch with loved ones. And all the obvious reasons, I don't need to go into the list as to what that provides you as a passenger. But even for an airline, the abilities to change the seat back in-flight entertainment experience by having Starlink on board, the world is your oyster. I think we are going to see many announcements ahead of streaming platforms and the big guys, God knows what their names are now because they're all buying each other. So whether that be Paramount or Netflix or Warner Brothers or whoever, okay, the opportunity now to integrate all of that, for example, into seatback is there because of Starlink. The opportunity to have a more seamless experience of interactions with the crew. Perhaps they are taking your meal order and they're using the little iPads, as many airlines use. Those iPads typically would have a SIM card in the iPad, and it's using cell signal while on the ground to be able to, or using rubbish Wi-Fi on board, to be able to note down that Dan in 1A wants to have the vegan meal from the menu.
So thank you.
He's selecting that. Now, the problem is for Dan and also for the crew is that the passenger in 1 kilo, let's say Oscar, for example, has beaten Dan to it and taken that last vegan meal. But on the traditional system, without Starlink, using the SIM card or the bad Wi-Fi, there's like a 45-second or 1-minute delay before it shows up on the iPad for the crew that, oh, actually, we don't have that anymore. It's already been allocated. So what I'm saying is Starlink serves as this platform, as this enabler across the passenger experience for crew, pilots, for being able to communicate on the ground, for being able to communicate during medical emergencies on board, during an onboard birth, they can now have systems in place where they are FaceTiming, or the equivalent to FaceTime, the medical teams on the ground to ensure that something like delivering a baby on board, which crew are qualified to do, is smooth and safe, and the ground assistance is going to be there with the adequate medication, for example. It's all just so holistic, and I really am pleased to see Korean Air become the first major Asian carrier. Didn't have that on our prediction list to commit to fleet-wide Starlink. I would say that, you know, Singapore Airlines, Cathay, Japan, what's good?
Yeah, 100%. And it's especially valuable for an airline like Korean, where their flights, all their flights to Europe, all their flights to US, and also to Australia are very, very long. Because Russian airspace is closed, their flights to Europe take up to 15 hours. So, you know, they're an airline where we truly need this. And I think it's really great. And as you said, Singapore, Cathay, Japanese airlines, they all operate similarly lengthy flights. So it will be really exciting to see that be introduced on them soon, hopefully. We just need a lot stricter rules and restrictions regarding consuming entertainment, talking on FaceTime and stuff without headphones.
The only thing that I feel will be difficult for Korean Air as well is that at the moment, Starlink doesn't work over China. And that's a Chinese authority rule. I hope that we get that. And I know that SpaceX are working on overcoming that challenge, but Starlink doesn't work there. So if that's kind of like a big portion of the flight without it until they address those concerns, until they come to a deal basically with China.
True. Good point. Moving over to Europe, another piece of exciting news that is incredibly long overdue is that Paris Charles de Gaulle, what do we call the lovely organization? Skytrax, the truth tellers of truth tellers, named this airport the best airport in Europe for 2025. This airport notoriously...
I like that when you said the best airport in Europe, you went up with a question mark. Because you know that we are asking you, the listeners, to be the better judge of such. Please continue.
Exactly. Some might say that rating alone is enough to discredit an organization. But in any case, this airport, Charles de Gaulle, is infamous for its complicated gate system. And specifically, they have Terminal 1, 2, 3. Terminal 1 and 3 are fine. It's not too complicated there. Mm. It's Terminal 2 where things get a little crazy because we have letters ranging from 2A to 2G. 2G is, you know, where Hop operates to Gothenburg. So I'm familiar with that little garage of a terminal.
You see, that's why I'm absolutely unfamiliar with it.
Exactly. But within, specifically, I mean, this would be complicated enough if it wasn't for the fact that within Terminal 2E, which is where Air France operates all their flights that are not to Gothenburg, that concourse, I guess, has three different sub-concourses called, is it KLM, which always cracks me up? Because you look at the signs and it says 2E KLM, and you're like, KLM? What?
It's awful. It's awful. It's so confusing. And you know, I go to Paris so much, and I can't tell you how much I stare at the booking to see like 2BD or 2B/2D, but my flight is 2C.
It's way too complicated for absolutely no reason. So what are they changing?
Well, they are abolishing, phasing out the very confusing 2A, 2B, 2C, 2D, 2E, all of that, and which itself hasn't stuck to, I mean, they for example, I know British Airways has moved. You've never been to that awful little basement area, have you?
I don't think so.
Where the BA check-in is at Charles de Gaulle. No. Listeners who have flown BA from Charles de Gaulle will know what I'm speaking about. If you ever needed greater evidence of Brexit and the relationship France has with the UK, just fly British Airways from Charles de Gaulle. Goodness, that is an unusual little arrangement there in the basement. But and the staff were absolutely horrible. I stand by that because it was. There are so many documented incidents of where the staff there are just absolutely irrational, unreasonable, and clearly hate the fact that they are somehow operating the desk of the UK flag carrier in this basement of the terminal. They don't even know what terminal they're in, and neither do the passengers, because who knows? It's 2B, Hall K, 5L, LBC, everything. Anyway. Charles de Gaulle is phasing out this confusing model. They are moving to what they are calling a cleaner system, which will involve numbers only and will allow for better planning. So basically, we're going to have Terminal 1, Terminal 2, Terminal 3, Terminal 4, Terminal 5, Terminal 6. What does it go up to? Is it, I feel like it's
7, and that's the Gothenburg 7. One.
Yes. Do you think, just for good measure, they could do like... If I get that they want to stick to numbers. Terminal so my proposal zero. To Charles de Gaulle is that they do Terminal like 7.1. That's the Gothenburg terminal. Right. So Terminal 7. Zero 6, is not a bad 6, idea.
6.
Yeah. But so out with this whole, you know, Terminal E, which has entrance K, L and M, not to be confused with KLM. You won't find them in Terminal E. Makes sense, yeah. Right? You're with me, right? Instead, it's going to be, as I said, Terminal 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. That's the end.
That's the end.
Yeah. And therefore, we do away with these sub letters. And I'm sure the transition is going to be messy. And I'm sure that documents are going to be printed, for example, or sitting in the emails of passengers that are pre the change. And also, I'm sure taxi drivers and hotel chauffeurs and are not going to be fully aligned with this. So anyone traveling to Paris, then just keep this in mind. But this is actually not for a while.
Until 2027. It won't happen. God. And also,
and here's us discussing at the end of 25.
I know. Goodness. And watch it not even happen by then. And let's also mention that I am quite doubtful that this will happen overnight. So surely there's going to be a few days where there's mixed signs and then everyone is confused and it's complete chaos, meaning we absolutely want to avoid this airport. Not, I mean, just in general, but especially during those dates, in my opinion.
Yeah. No, you're right. We'll keep an eye on it. We've got time. But, you know, Charles de Gaulle, have you also noticed something? This is something that I'm always aware of when, and this does depend on the country, and I think we need to see what the consistency is here. Definitely the listeners have noticed this or thought this at one point. But Charles de Gaulle is an airport where the signage suggests that if something is ahead yes. of you, so for you to continue walking straight, the arrow points down.
It is insane.
If it's behind you, it points up. Not yeah. to be confused with upstairs on another level. And I always think to myself, I have to make a note. Is this a France thing? Is this the same in Toulouse and Bordeaux? Or is this... And then, of course, you cross over to Spain where... Now, I can't remember which way. Is it the arrow points up or down for you to continue walking in a straight line? Okay, if we were designing an airport and the idea is you have to walk straight, how would you have the arrow?
Like the rest of the world, facing upwards, which means forwards, yeah. right?
So then how do you get over the complication of showing that something is on the level above? I think you just write, for example, level 2.
No. Then you right? have like a... There's that global symbol with a sideways... person sort of indicating going up an escalator
going
kind
up
of thing.
Yes
or
yes,
a sideways
yes.
an arrow going diagonally up.
That
means up
yes
yeah
so it's showing the transition up indicating
exactly
an escalator or an elevator and so on.
I mean I'm sure that must be how they do it in all of France. It's just tricky because at an international airport you're serving a lot of people who are not from France. So then what do you choose? Of course, you know, the French go with the French system, but I have been confused quite a few times by that and I keep forgetting. And then I have to remind myself when I'm there, right, that means forwards, not backwards.
Yeah, it's a France thing. So I'm just checking. In France, an arrow pointing down on road signs usually means straight ahead. That's on road signs. And this continues into the airport. The thing is, though, listeners have sent me, and there is evidence of this, in the same messy airport, Charles de Gaulle, there are signs to go down where something is on the level down. And of course, the arrow points down.
Yeah.
So
crazy.
That's messy.
The
Do
whole
you think,
needs to change.
If you were the boss of a global, let's say like a global hub, not a small airport, but a global hub, okay? Do you have the escalators, the travelators, the flat ones, okay? Do you have them moving forward in the direction of I guess that depends what side you're coming from. Okay. Right. Basically, what I'm trying to say is you're on the left side or you're on the right side. If you're in a hallway and you've got the travelator moving, one forward and one back, do you copy the side of the road that the country drives in?
Or no, do you reverse that? I don't know if you've noticed this, but even in the UK, for example, people know inherently that you should be on the right side because, for example, on an escalator in the UK, people will walk on the right side and stand still on the left side, right?
No. Other way around.
They will.
You're talking. Go on.
Basically, the ones going up will always be on the right side, which is, I'm pretty sure that's the case in the UK. Anyway, I forget how, but we notice that people will always choose the right side for things, even in countries where you drive on the other side of the road. So I think the travelator should always, the one going forward, I mean, not that it really matters, but if
hang on, you're saying the one going forward when you're in that direction.
In your direction, the direction you're heading should be on the right side, but that's not as important as just good signage.
No, yeah.
And by the way, let's just mention a working travelator is the most important thing because most of the time,
CC France,
Germany,
exactly.
Amsterdam, seriously. Amsterdam, works. Skip
nothing works there. I love that you did that reel that went viral of you saying like, you're back from Asia for all those months, then nothing works because I mean, nothing works. That's the standard. Like, it's like you're crazy for expecting it to work. That's what I love. We've got to this place where it's you're how snobby of you to want the escalators to work. What's wrong with you?
Yeah, it was literally like a comedy show because we show up to the airport with so much luggage because we're like dragging a bunch of stuff home to Sweden for family and gifts and all this stuff. So then we want to take the elevator. Nope, all the elevators are closed. There's like tape in front of them. So then, fine, we'll take the rising travelator. So you should be, like in an ideal scenario, those things should have magnetic connections to your luggage cart. So the cart gets stuck so you don't have to hold it. And then it takes you up to the next floor. No. First of all, it doesn't have that type of connection. Second of all, it's not even working. So we have to push our luggage up on a broken travelator with no working escalator
to the second floor.
It's just so crazy.
But don't complain about it because you're being elitist. Yeah. You're being snobby. Why are you expecting things to work, Dan? That's so stupid of you. It's the struggle. So, they're conditioning the people to believe that the struggle is now the norm.
Yeah, I know. So let's just focus quickly on what are some, we should have a positive angle on this. What are, we've spoken about this before, but let's mention like five airports in Europe that do it well, that do it correctly.
Zurich, I think.
I agree.
Things just tend to work. Things really do work. The only thing I don't like is that they still have this old way of going through security. Remember I said where you will kind of line up after each other. There's not, they haven't even, the simultaneous, you know, the floor print of the footprints where you can all do it at the same time in parallel. That hasn't even arrived there yet, let alone the new machines. So that's a shame. But otherwise, Zurich tends to work very well. Germany, I think, oh no, you said no negative. Okay, so
yes, let's stick to positive. I mean, I will say, I think Scandinavia is really strong here.
Yes,
but not only Scandinavia, but Helsinki, I would say, I mean, we've said this before.
Helsinki, fantastic. Stockholm, Arlanda. Yeah.
Stockholm is a bit, it can be good, but it can also be really bad. For example, they don't have any e-gates in Stockholm yet. So even EU citizens have to stand in the same line as everyone else, which is rare in Europe.
Oh my God, you just reminded me of something super important to warn everyone as we approach another busy travel season. If you are arriving from outside of the EU, do not, under any circumstances, if you can control it, arrive into Lisbon from outside of the EU. Because Lisbon, have you seen the videos? This has been pretty consistent throughout the year, but it's even worse at the moment. The queues at immigration are hours. People are there for hours and hours. It has been a nightmare. It was a nightmare all summer. It's been a nightmare coming out of summer. There was a brief period in October, November, and that's only because air travel demand weakens in those weeks. And just as air travel demand comes back up now, it is a nightmare. Loads of you have got in touch with me and sent me these videos standing in these awful long queues. Even crew and pilots who just operated 7-8 hour flights to Lisbon are standing in these long queues. It's a mess. You have to be able to do your best to enter Europe via anywhere else, and then you can arrive as a domestic European Schengen flight, you know, so you can arrive as a Schengen passenger, meaning you don't clear immigration and you can you can exit immediately, because it's a real, real mess. And I think it's only going to get worse. It's been like this all year. They haven't addressed the issues, the staffing shortages. There's been unions at play, of course, and so on. But if you're able to control it, enter somewhere else and then either connect and you'll be fine.
Good tip. We should mention, we need to get to 5 airports that we like. So we've said Helsinki, we've said Zurich. I would not say,
well, it's not really that we like, it's the ones that we think that
do the best,
you know, job. Those kind of awful, yeah, they make sure their escalators are working, they make sure things are ticking over and smooth and running.
Exactly. I think Oslo is actually beautiful. Yeah, Oslo, in most parts.
Gardermoen, or however you
exactly
say.
Exactly. Yeah, that's pretty good. I mean,
Rome works well.
Yeah, I guess it's just,
it's busy, but it does work well. You don't have to take anything out of your bags. The doors open, the escalators work, you can have very long walks, but on the whole, Rome works well.
Yeah. Okay, so
Fiumicino, not the Ryanair one.
Yeah. And should we finally, can we include like London City? Because in some ways it's
I was just about to say City. Yeah, I think there's only one escalator in the building, so you'd hope that they'd get it to work. But
even though it's dingy, it's so efficient.
It is efficient. Easy. The fact that you can arrive so, you know, close to your flight departure time, and things tend to work there. And they've got the great DLR, which is arguably the best part of the UK London Underground system. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think London City. Is that 5?
Yeah, that's 5. So our list is Zurich, Helsinki, Oslo, Rome, London City.
Nice.
So let's wrap up here with one more topic, which is that, you know what, I find it kind of crazy that we've had this podcast so long that there have now been 3 Qatar Airways CEOs in the time that we've hosted on air.
That's true. Considering there wasn't any change for 27 years under Akbar al-Bakr, it's true that now the new appointment, I'm sure many of the listeners have seen. So the a new CEO of the Qatar Airways Group has been named. It's Hamad Al-Khater, who is the comes from the airport, who he was until this appointment, the chief operating officer of Hamad International Airport. And Hamad Al-Khater now becomes the group CEO, effective immediately. And so that means that Badr Al-Meer, who will discuss kind of quickly what his premiership will be known for, but it means that he served 2 years in the position, which followed 11 years at Hamad Airport. So Badr has been with the Qatar Airways Group at holding C-level positions there for 13, almost 14 years. Mm-hmm. And most of that at the airport. I think for me, I would say Badr's greatest achievement, I think that he could look back on, would be the delivery of the Orchard and the expansion of Hamad Airport. Because from and I always try to check if this is accurate, but in terms of with the global comparisons, I cannot remember another airport that opened ahead of schedule and was actually finished and done, you know, and in time for a World Cup. That's something unprecedented. Even the sharpest of engineering projects, like for example in the UAE, where they are also famous for getting things done very quickly, even they have struggled with their airport expansion. They've been delayed, they've been suspended, run out of money and so on. But that Orchard delivery, I think, is perhaps his single greatest achievement in his time at the top of the group.
So, you know, the huge question when Akbar al-Bakr left, since he was Qatar Airways to a lot of people, he was at the helm of that airline for so long, he shaped what it was, he turned it into one of the world's best airlines, 100%. When Badr came in, there was a lot of high hopes and anticipations for what kind of changes we would see. And I guess to give a very brief overview of what has changed, I think, you know, for his time at the airline, there's two things that he can be incredibly proud of, which is one, that he is very well liked by the staff, by the crew, by people who work there, for greatly improving their working conditions and making the crew in general a lot happier at the airline. That's from true. What we've heard.
It was a cultural transformation in that sense, in terms of the working culture.
So you know, that's definitely something to be proud of. And also, of course, Qatar Airways had their most profitable year ever last year, and they were one of the most profitable airlines in the world, which is another huge accomplishment. You know, one thing that I think a lot of people are looking at now from Hamad Al-Khater is, can he continue the positives while also bringing a bit of that, I don't want to say flair, but something that existed during Akbar Al-Bakr's time that a lot of people feel has dwindled a little bit. So you'll see people say that there's perhaps a bit more inconsistency, maybe, you know, as a negative consequence of something much more important, that the crew is much happier, or that there have been cost cuts somewhere to enable, you know, these record profits. So will he be able to bring the refinement of that Al-Bakr brought, and that attention to detail, maybe from the customer perspective, while also keeping the positive changes the batter brought about? That's what we're curious about. And, you know, I have high hopes that Hamad can give us that. Because, you know, like if I think back to 2023, even during Al-Bakr's final year, I started noticing a few changes from what we, you know, would think of in 2018 or 2019, especially before COVID, when we were flying Qatar Airways, that made us so excited. So it's things like that that I hope he can bring back. You know, if he's listening to this, I remember it's the small things, like, you know, we always talk about how we focus about on business class on this channel or on this podcast, but I never, ever forget. And I always mention how in 2018, I had this flight to Bangkok where for no particular reason, I was given 6 hot towels on a 6-hour flight. And it's something about how unnecessary and how extra that was.
That sounds wasteful to me. That sounds wasteful.
But it leaves such a good impression on you when you feel like, wow, there's really nothing is spared here. And that was so fun. So of course it's wasteful. Of course I didn't need it. But that, you know, that's what made it so exciting to fly any airline in the Gulf back in the day when they were throwing money at everything just to be as good as possible. So we're excited to see what happens going
It's forward. Worthy context to remind that unlike in, for example, in the United States or UK, France, and so on, with Qatar Airways and Emirates and Etihad, with these airlines being the state-owned airlines of the Gulf, and there are many state-owned airlines across Asia as well, and even across Scandinavia and Dan's region, but with state-owned airlines like Qatar, these appointments are typically appointments from the government. So political appointments whereby the government decide who will assume the role and when. And so that's why you do tend to get pretty sudden decisions that the rest of the world often can perceive to be either unusual or how did they not know about the next guy. But actually, for anyone that is familiar with the Gulf, it's pretty business as usual here in terms of how big appointments across big organizations, state-owned organizations, are made. We absolutely wish Badr well, because he can look back at both his time at Qatar Airways at the top of it, but also at the airport with decent memories, but also with, as you said, that kind of cultural transformation that led to him being really respected by the staff. And also, Hamad's got, you know, a really exciting new mandate and period ahead, and a period of growth with massive aircraft orders coming into this region, not least into Qatar Airways, with a big order that Badr had signed with Boeing not too long ago in May of this year. and all the aircraft that are ahead, the 321 Neos, more 350s. It will be the introduction of the Singoal long range. There's the 777X that will finally make its debut. There's a big Dreamliner order. So he's got a big growth agenda ahead. And that's an exciting task for anyone to be able to get their head around and then get going with. So yeah, we wish him the best.
Exactly. And he's taking over a healthy airline, which is a nice place to start in.
Definitely.
And hopefully he can change the safety video ASAP, because that's my personal wish. Good riddance.
Quite loud and quite long, isn't it?
Yes, and quite not aligned with the brand. But anyway.
Shall we move into Q&A?
Let's do it. Okay, so by the way, I want to start off here by saying thank you so much to everyone who tuned in this year and tagged us in your stories saying we were in your top 5 YouTube channels.
Oh my God, I love this. It was the like Spotify Wrapped, but everyone's doing Wrapped now. And we're at the top of that was so cool.
So cool.
Loved that. Thank you for that. Keep them coming. If we featured in your Wrapped on Spotify, we want to see it. We want to be tagged and we send our thanks. That's really, really cool.
Amazing.
Or YouTube or whoever.
Exactly. So we have two questions here from Jack. The first one I feel like we've spoken about. So just briefly, would we rather fly BA out of Terminal 3 or Terminal 5 at Heathrow?
If it's Terminal the first three, wing as a One World Emerald, then I would rather steal T5.
Wow. I 100% T3 for
T3 if it's not the first lounges. Wing. Yeah, cafe. Yeah, you're right. Actually.
I mean, hello, if you're leaving from like 5B or 5C, it's not so fun anymore, which more and more inter-European flights are doing. So
you're right. And also the for example, you remember that flight where I almost missed it because I thought Toulouse was definitely Terminal 5. When I went to T3, the novelty of having beautiful dim sum at 5 o'clock in the morning in the cafe lounge before a short haul BA flight to Toulouse. That felt great.
It's amazing. And then you can hop down to Qantas and have some other nice dishes. It's just so nice.
G'day. Welcome to Qantas.
And if you go to the American Airlines lounge, are you doing?
I'm not doing that.
Jack also asks, I guess this is more for me, what are our thoughts on Cathay Pacific strictly enforcing their new policies regarding frequent flyer status and approval? Basically, you could give one status a check-in so you could get into a lounge and then change the card you're giving before your flight so you earn points elsewhere if you want to transition your program or something like that. So Cathay Pacific has basically stopped allowing that. So now if you want to use your status to get into the lounge, you need to also credit your flight to that program. This is a niche issue only for extreme frequent flyers, but I will say that this is a increasingly common development, unfortunately, and I think it's quite unfortunate to see them restricting how you can use your status, where you can credit points. And ultimately, it seems damaging to me because when an airline grants you access to a lounge, let's say you use your BA status to get into a Cathay Pacific lounge, even if you're flying on Cathay Pacific, British Airways is paying Cathay Pacific for that lounge use. So they're deriving revenue from you doing that, right? It doesn't make it's just a weird
I thought it was weird. It felt very unfriendly. I didn't think it didn't make much sense either.
Yeah, exactly. Next up, we have a question here from Mike. He says he's a Belgian-American travel hacker from London doing 40-plus flights a year in business and first class. Awesome. My question is, why is it legal and considered acceptable that airlines are overselling more seats than they have capacity for? Even if they calculate that they typically have a few no-shows, the experience for passengers who have bought a ticket and are bumped out of the plane is truly horrendous, especially at critical times like family holidays. How can this be legal and acceptable, and why aren't regulators banning this awful practice? Great question, actually. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, this is, overselling is allowed. This is the thing. It's legal by almost all aviation regulators, and that's who this would stand with. The buck would stop with them. So it's legal in the US, with the US Department for Transport, of course, with the EU, around Asia, across the continent of Africa. The airline has to abide by some clear rules, though. But as you say, they're really uncomfortable when they, when they board and they say, right, we need volunteers or we're going to choose at random. I mean, it's suddenly like the Hunger Games in those scenarios. Mm-hmm. The thing is that they oversell because airlines work on the tightest margins ever, and if they didn't, they wouldn't be profitable. And that's the reality. And if they were not profitable, they wouldn't be able to invest or expand or serve you as the passenger better. They know that a certain percentage of passengers won't show up. Who? What's the name of the gentleman who asked the question?
Mike. Here we
go. Mike, you know this anyway, as you mentioned in your question, that you know that it's because there are no shows, and that will be due to missed connections, people not waking up, cancellations, whatever. But they have to move ahead with this equation in order to avoid flying with empty seats. And it does keep fares lower. And that's the only thing I can say that should be the takeaway, that, you know, hopefully over the course of your flying life, you may never, you know, statistically, you may never be affected by overbooking or overselling. And if you have been more than once or twice, perhaps it's because of the certain route that you fly, maybe a smaller aircraft. I'm thinking, for example, when you're flying an Embraer in the US, you know, we see those announcements where they're looking for volunteers and all that. But you can get through flying quite a bit around the world in life without ever being near to this eventuality. And as a result, the takeaway is that this helps keep fares lower. And if we had regulators and aviation authorities stepping in to ban the act or the art of overselling, then those fares are going to go up and we're all going to suffer. So unfortunately, it does kind of have to stay how it is.
And to look at it from a positive perspective, first of all, this is one area, the US is really good with passenger making things right if something small goes wrong. Like, let's say your Wi-Fi isn't working, your recline doesn't work. They're very good at compensating. And they're also extremely good at compensating in situations where you're on an overbooked flight. And in the US, unlike most of the rest of the world, they do this bidding system, which a lot of listeners will, of course, know, where is anyone willing to accept $500 for this, to skip this flight and take the next one? Nope. Okay, what about $1,000? Nope. Okay, what about, you know, and they can get up to $10,000 or higher sometimes, which can be a great payday for someone who's not in a huge hurry. And a lot of the time they even ask you a check-in on the big check-in machines, would you be willing to take a later flight if you're overbooked? Let's also remember that a lot of the time, I mean, the more frequent occurrence for me, which has happened like twice in my life, compared to, I've never been bumped from a flight because it's been overbooked, but I have been upgraded twice because economy has been overbooked. So there you have a positive effect of the overbooking. So, you know, it doesn't always have to be a bad thing. And finally, of course, if your flight is overbooked and you're flying a European airline or you're flying out of the EU or UK, you will get compensation by law for reaching your destination delayed. So
true. Yes, very, very true. With that, we will wrap with a little note to say that the next episode in your feeds will be the final episode of the year from our side. And we'll have a little more of a lighthearted one. We'll have a reflect. We'll look ahead. Perhaps we'll play a couple of little games or something. We'll see how it goes. We'll have a fun one to end the year as we approach Christmas and the new year. So that will be the next episode in your feeds. And so we'll catch you then.
We will see you next Wednesday, as always, on air. Bye-bye.
See you later.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers. I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/GLP-1. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now, it's your turn. Weight Watchers, watch it work.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.